This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of internal impingement from the shoulder and elbow section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick summary. Internal impingement is a cause of shoulder pain in overhead athletes caused by repetitive impingement between the undersurface of the rotator cuff and the posterosuperior glenoid. Diagnosis is made clinically with worsening posterior shoulder pain during maximal abduction and external rotation, that is the position of late cocking, associated with decreased internal rotation and supplemented with MRI, showing posterior rotator cuff and posterior labral pathology. Treatment with physical therapy and posterior capsule stretching is effective for most patients. Arthroscopic surgery is indicated for patients who fail conservative management. Now let's get into the episode. With respect to epidemiology, this is the major cause of shoulder pain in throwing and overhead athletes. Moving on to etiology, in terms of pathophysiology, as far as mechanism, impingement occurs during maximum arm abduction and external rotation during the late cocking and early acceleration phases of throwing. This causes a quote-unquote peel-back phenomenon of the posterosuperior labrum by the biceps. The pathoanatomy of internal impingement is caused by repetitive impingement of the posterior undersurface of the supraspinatus tendon and the posterior superior aspect of the glenoid. The pathologic micromotion of the humeral head allows the rotator cuff to become impinged between the humeral head and the glenoid. In contrast to the subacromial or external impingement, which occurs on the bursal side of the rotator cuff. Internal impingement covers a spectrum of injuries, including fraying of the posterior rotator cuff, that is the supraspinatus-infraspinatus interval, posterior and superior labral lesions, hypertrophy and scarring of the posterior capsule glenoid, otherwise known as a Bennett lesion, and cartilage damage at the posterior glenoid. The etiology of internal impingement can be secondary to tightness of the posterior band of the IGHL and or anterior microinstability. As far as associated conditions, internal impingement is associated with GERD, or glenohumeral internal rotation deficit. Other associated conditions include slap tears and a sick scapula, as well as dyskinesia. Now, let's go over some relevant anatomy. For a full review of glenohumeral joint anatomy, be sure to listen to the podcast episode entitled Glenohumeral Joint Anatomy, Stabilizer, and Biomechanics. However, in this episode, we'll go over glenohumeral stability and the anatomy of the rotator cuff. So glenohumeral stability depends on static restraints and dynamic restraints. Static restraints include the glenohumeral ligaments, the glenoid labrum, articular congruity and version, as well as negative intraarticular pressure. Dynamic restraints include the rotator cuff muscles, biceps, and periscapular muscles. Moving on to the rotator cuff, the primary function is dynamic stability and centering the humeral head within the glenoid by balancing the force couples about the glenohumeral joint in both coronal and transverse planes, creating a stable fulcrum. So in the coronal plane, the inferior rotator cuff, which includes the infraspinatus, teres minor, and subscapularis, balances the superior moment of the deltoid. In the transverse plane, the anterior cuff, or the subscapularis, balances the posterior moment of the posterior cuff, which includes the infraspinatus and teres minor. The goal of treatment in rotator cuff tears is to restore this equilibrium in all planes. Moving on to classification, know that there is no formal classification scheme for internal impingement. Moving on to presentation, symptoms of internal impingement include shoulder pain, sometimes localized posteriorly. This will manifest with diffuse pain in the posterior shoulder along the posterior deltoid. Know that shoulder pain is worse with throwing, especially during the late cocking and early acceleration phases. On physical exam, in terms of inspection, you may see retroversion of the proximal humerus, as well as pain with palpation along the infraspinatus. Physical exam should also evaluate range of motion, and in the setting of internal impingement, there will be increased external rotation and decreased internal rotation, specifically loss of greater than 20 degrees of internal rotation at 90 degrees compared to the contralateral shoulder. Know that you must stabilize the scapula to get a true measure of the glenohumeral rotation. Finally, range of motion assessment will also reveal that there will be preservation of the total arc of motion in the setting of internal impingement. As far as strength evaluation, you can often demonstrate rotator cuff weakness in the setting of internal impingement. Provocative tests to know include the Whipple test and the apprehension test. The Whipple test is performed to test for partial supraspinatus tears and is performed by ranging the shoulder in forward flexion, adduction, and scapular retraction, and is positive when pain is reproduced on resistance. As far as the apprehension test, this is positive for internal impingement and is performed by bringing the shoulder into maximum external rotation, abduction, and extension. The apprehension test is positive if posterior shoulder pain is reproduced in this position and relieved when the arm is brought into neutral extension slash flexion. Moving on to imaging, recommended views on radiographs include a complete shoulder series. Findings are usually unremarkable, and the AP may show a Bennett lesion, that is exostosis of the posteroinferior glenoid. Moving on to MRI or MR arthrogram, findings can show pathology of the rotator cuff and or labral pathology, such as partial articular-sided supraspinatus infraspinatus tendon avulsion, otherwise known as a pasta lesion, as well as fraying or a tear. Remember that MRI or MR arthrogram in the setting of internal impingement can show a signal at the greater tuberosity and or the posterior superior labrum. As far as optional views, ABR positioning, that is abduction and external rotation, reproduces the position of impingement, showing a dynamic process on the humerus and glenoid sides. Moving on to the treatment of internal impingement, this can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management includes physical therapy, cessation from throwing, as well as posterior capsule stretching. In terms of indications, this is the first line of treatment, and know that most internal impingement can be treated non-operatively. Operative treatment should only be considered if the patient has failed adequate physical therapy for an extended period of time, as results following operative intervention are unpredictable. Operative options include arthroscopic debridement of the rotator cuff and or labrum, arthroscopic versus mini open rotator cuff and or labral repair, and posterior capsule release versus anterior capsular stabilization. Arthroscopic debridement of the rotator cuff and or labrum is indicated when there is a failure of non-operative treatment and a partial thickness rotator cuff tear, otherwise known as a pasta lesion, that compromises the integrity of the rotator cuff. Know that partial rotator cuff tears are defined as less than 50%. Arthroscopic debridement of the rotator cuff and or labrum is also indicated in the setting of Bennett lesions as well as a peelback labral lesion. In terms of arthroscopic versus mini open rotator cuff and or labral repair, this is indicated for partial tears greater than 50% of the tendon thickness or full thickness tears. This option is also indicated for unstable labral tears. Finally, moving on to posterior capsule release versus anterior capsular stabilization, this is indicated for persistent posterior capsule contracture or anterior shoulder instability, in addition to any of the pathology that we just mentioned. Now, let's go over some of these management techniques in a bit more detail. So starting with physical therapy, cessation from throwing, and posterior capsule stretching, cessation is defined as a break from throwing until the pain has subsided, followed by supervised return to throwing, focusing on proper mechanics. Therapy includes a posterior capsular stretching program, for example, sleeper stretches, as well as rotator cuff strength balancing, scapular stabilization, and kinetic chain coordination. Know that patients should be involved in a stretching program for at least 6 months. Outcomes are correlated with compliance to the therapy regimen. Moving on to arthroscopic debridement of the rotator cuff tear and or labrum, in terms of diagnostic arthroscopy, you should perform a meticulous exam under anesthesia to assess range of motion, and then diagnostic arthroscopy should be done intraarticularly and subacromially. In terms of debridement, an arthroscopic shaver should be used to debride loose tissue edges. Arthroscopic debridement of a rotator cuff tear and or labrum allows accelerated rehab and return to throwing, as well as shorter post-op immobilization time. Moving on to arthroscopic versus mini open rotator cuff repair, in terms of the approach, know that arthroscopic repair has the advantage of addressing labral and other intraarticular pathology. In terms of acromioplasty, know that bursectomy is performed to visualize the bursal side of the tendon. Acromioplasty is not indicated if no bursal-sided pathology is seen. Cuff repair involves abrasive preparation of the greater tuberosity footprint. A portal of Wilmington is usually necessary in the setting of cuff repair. For partial thickness tears, you can perform an in-situ transtendinous repair. This involves a pulley technique utilizing suture anchors to reduce the tendon to the tuberosity, and this will functionally shorten the tendon length. Finally, be sure to complete a partial tear followed by an anatomic repair technique. This can be done with a single or double row repair. Finally, in terms of the labrum, be sure to prepare the glenoid rim and repair the unstable labral tear. Finally, moving on to posterior capsular release versus anterior stabilization, in terms of a posterior release, this is done adjunctively with the procedures that we just mentioned. Know that a cautery wand or an arthroscopic shaver can be used to release the synovium and capsular tissues. However, keep in mind that a posterior capsular release will have the risk of axillary nerve injury. In terms of anterior stabilization, this can also be done adjunctively with the procedures that we previously mentioned. Know that capsular plication is the most common form of anterior stabilization. Finally, let's end this review session talking about complications of internal impingement. The ones to know include progression to full thickness rotator cuff tear, delayed rate of return to play, and axillary nerve injury. So in terms of progression to full thickness rotator cuff tear, know that there's a small risk to partial tears treated with debridement alone. In terms of delayed rate of return to play, know that there are worse rates following rotator cuff repairs in throwing athletes. Finally, as far as axillary nerve injury, know that the axillary nerve is at risk during posterior release at the inferior border of the infraspinatus. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic might be tested. First question. A 25-year-old right-handed baseball pitcher presents with persistent shoulder pain for the past several months in his dominant throwing arm. On physical examination, he is found to have full arc of motion with the exception of an internal rotation deficit of 30 degrees compared to his contralateral side. He is asked to complete sleeper stretch exercises. This form of rehabilitation is meant to address pathology in which anatomic structure? And the choices are 1. Superior glenohumeral ligament, 2. Middle glenohumeral ligament, 3. Anterior band of the inferior glenohumeral ligament, 4. Superior band of the inferior glenohumeral ligament, and 5. Posterior band of the inferior glenohumeral ligament. The correct answer to this question is 5. Posterior band of the inferior glenohumeral ligament. So a sleeper stretch stretches the contracted posterior soft tissues in patients demonstrating symptoms of internal impingement. The sleeper stretch helps to address posterior tightness, and the only posterior structure listed in the responses is the posterior band of the inferior glenohumeral ligament, or posterior IGHL. To quickly review, internal impingement is a significant cause of pain in throwing athletes. It results from impingement of the articular undersurface of the posterior supraspinatus against the posterior superior glenoid. This is thought to be secondary to tightness in the posterior soft tissues, including the capsule and posterior band of the IGHL. The mainstay of non-operative management is posterior capsular stretching with the sleeper stretches and crossbody adduction stretches. Hayworth et al. Review the etiology, diagnosis, and management of internal impingement of the shoulder. They note that repetitive contact between the greater tuberosity and glenoid rim posterior superiorly lead to impingement of the posterior rotator cuff and labrum. This occurs when the arm is externally rotated and abducted. Tyler et al. Reviewed the effects of posterior capsular stretching on alleviating symptoms in patients with internal impingement. 22 patients were assessed using quote-unquote sleeper stretches. The authors found that while posterior shoulder tightness improved with this rehabilitation, overall internal rotation deficits did not. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, superior glenohumeral ligament, and answer 2, middle glenohumeral ligament are both incorrect, as neither of these structures are implicated in internal impingement. Answer 3, anterior band of the inferior glenohumeral ligament is incorrect, as the anterior band of the IGHL may demonstrate increased laxity in internal impingement, not tightness. Finally, answer 4, superior band of the inferior glenohumeral ligament is incorrect, as the superior band of the IGHL is found to have the most strain in slap lesions, but is not the focus of the sleeper stretch. And moving on to the next question. The term internal impingement is used in throwers to describe a condition where the posterior superior glenoid labrum impinges on which structure. And the choices are 1, the anterior rotator cuff, 2, the posterior rotator cuff, 3, the anterior glenohumeral ligaments, 4, the posterior glenohumeral ligaments, and 5, the biceps tendon. The correct answer to this question is 2, the posterior rotator cuff. So internal impingement is seen in throwers with the arm in a cocked position of abduction and external rotation. Often due to posterior soft tissue tightness, the posterior cuff impinges on the posterior superior labrum and is felt to contribute to slap tears and articular-sided cuff tears. And moving on to the final question, internal impingement commonly occurs in overhead athletes and is very common amongst elite baseball pitchers. In which phase of throwing does this pathologic process occur? And the choices are 1, wind-up, 2, early cocking, 3, late cocking, 4, deceleration, and 5, follow-through. The correct answer to this question is 3, late cocking. So internal impingement refers to the impingement within the glenohumeral joint, which occurs as the posterior superior glenoid labrum makes contact with the greater tuberosity, causing impingement on the posterior rotator cuff. This occurs commonly among baseball pitchers during late cocking and early acceleration as the shoulder joint reaches its maximum external rotation. Drakos et al. Studied internal impingement in overhead athletes. In their review, they describe how adaptations to throwing including increased external rotation, increased humeral and glenoid retroversion, and anterior laxity all predispose these individuals to internal impingement. They recommend initial non-operative treatment with a focus on increasing the range of motion and improving scapular function. If this fails, surgical treatment should address micro-instability to ensure good outcomes. That's all for this review about internal impingement. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on OrthoBullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you aren't already, be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.